The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmn.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from Master Dogen's 300 Koan Shobogenzo, case 41. Sherdos Ask the Pillar, the main case. Master Sherto was once asked by a student, "What is the meaning of Bodhidharma coming from India?" Sherto said, "Ask the pillar." The student said, "I don't understand it." Sherto said, "I don't understand it either." The commentary. This question has been rattling around Zen monasteries since ancient times, and hundreds of various answers given by different masters are recorded in the literature, which makes it impossible to come to any logical conclusion regarding the meaning of Bodhidharma coming from India. If the truth of this koan is not to be found in logic or rationalizations, then where is it to be found? What does it mean to ask the pillar? Haven't you heard Master Dogen saying, "You should put your questions to a pillar and practice intensively with a wall"? If you wish to penetrate this barrier, you must first see that mind and objects are a single reality. Then all dualities merge into a single thusness. At just such a time, self and other, is and is not, good and bad, are no longer seen in the realm of yin and yang. The student doesn't understand. The master doesn't understand. Is the master and the disciples not understanding the same or different? If you say the same, you've missed it. If you say different, you've missed it. If you say neither or both, you're still miles away from the truth. So, what will you say? The capping verse. There is no place to search for the truth, though it's right beneath your feet, it can't be found. Look at springtime, when the snow is melted, the scars of the landscape are no longer hidden. So, Bodhidharma Sesshin. In the early years, when we were naming, my teacher, was naming the Sesshins, he named it Bodhidharma Sesshin because in February he would go and visit his teacher in Los Angeles, Mozumi Roshi, to work towards finishing his training because he hadn't completed it yet. And so that left a very young, green sangha here to do Sesshin. There were, well, of course, in the early years, there were no seniors. And so there was no one to give talks, certainly no one to do interview. And so when I first came, the Bodhidharma Sesshin was not even a full week, because I think at that point, the thought of doing a whole week of Sesshin with no talks and no interview, I think the fear was just that the whole place would explode or something, or that people would just dissolve into, I don't know, trouble. So it was usually, I think, Thursday to Sunday. And then as the Sangha matured and things changed, then it became a full week. And then I think it was just a normal Sesshin for a long time. And then some years ago, we went back to not doing interview and talks as a way of, as I said on Monday night, sort of in the spirit of Bodhidharma, this image of Bodhidharma facing the wall in this cave for 9 years on Shaolin Mountain. And so rather than, because usually I take up some of Bodhidharma's teachings or the koans that involve Bodhidharma, but I thought to sort of center these couple of talks around this question that became a kind of, I don't want to say signature question, it's not quite the right way of describing it, but a question that seemed to have been asked over and over and over again by students during their early years of Chan in China as a way of basically asking, what is the true Dharma? What is enlightenment? It was sort of a question that contained all of the essential guts of what Bodhidharma is about. What is the meaning of Bodhidharma is coming from the West, from India to China? And so Dada Roshi says in another place, in answer to this question, Dongshan said, wait until Dung Creek flows backwards, and then I'll tell you. Yanto, in answer to the same question, said, if you move Mount Lu, then I'll let you know. Kwai Wei said, wait until nobody's here, and then I'll tell you. Here, Shurto said, ask the pillar. And there are truly, probably hundreds of just recorded responses to this question, even just within the case koans. And so as Dada Roshi says, it's clear that there's no kind of study of these answers that's going to come up with some sort of logical conclusion as to what is the answer to this question. And so it really begs the question, are all of these responses the same? Are they all saying the same thing, pointing to the same thing? Are they different? The Buddhist path is really essentially based in inquiry. It's really based, you know, we could say that it's based in the recognition that life is dukkha and the desire to be free of that, to live a life that is unfettered, unhindered. But to make that alive, operative, you might say, we have to inquire, what the hell's going on? Right? Why is it that every other creature seems to live with its within its environment, within a basis about human consciousness, the human mind, thoughts, language, human nature, that makes life so complicated? And so to examine, you know, why is it said over and over again that the basic things that need to be that need to be brought forward when we study the Dharma is first we have to encounter it, we have to hear it, and then we have to reflect. And in that reflection is inquiry. We're examining. We're trying to understand, even though it may still be conceptual, we're trying to understand the teachings, the Dharma. What is being said? What are the instructions pointing to? We normally ask a question with language. So what kind of language do we use? How do we frame that question? And importantly, or essentially, how do we frame it within our mind in such a way, because we're using language, that very language, that question itself, just doesn't get us more tangled up in ideas? Or how do we not use that question so that it gives us a satisfying answer? It gives us some knowledge, but it doesn't actually stop the burning. And so what we see is that the essence of the question, to speak of it that way, the inquiry, which isn't limited to or ultimately in a word or a phrase or a question that you can put into English or any language. It's a matter that comes from within. You know, the first koans in koan training is a good example of that, the koan mu. Mu means no or absent or empty. But when the student works on that koan, asks that question, in their first koan, their instruction is don't engage the meaning of the word. So then in order for it not just to be an abstraction, the student has to bring into that question all of their longing, everything that they're seeking, everything that must be clarified in order to gain peace. In other words, they have to bring it to life. Bring it up, make it alive, make it an imperative. And so then you can see how, because that is important, And, you know, emphasizing the nature of inquiry, how this sits within each practitioner is within each practitioner. There's no one way. There's nothing fixed about this. There's not a formula or some particular question or way in which a person should be experiencing this or asking this that is a rule. Nor is it static. It evolves. But it becomes clear that it can't come from someone else. In other words, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma coming from the West? So here's an essential question. What is Mu? But does it mean that the person who is hearing that hears it as an essential question? That doesn't mean that in hearing that question, it brings forth something essential or some imperative. That's what happens within practice. I think as we come closer, as practice actually really begins to take root and come alive, this all becomes more present and close and alive within the student. And in bringing that forth, which is basically the question of our suffering, how do we hold that in such a way that it doesn't just eat us up? Right? In other words, how do you, in facing what we'd rather not face, in acknowledging what we'd rather pretend doesn't exist, how do we begin to really hold that within ourselves in a way that's very alive and felt in such a way that it doesn't just overwhelm? And so to take your practice seriously, to take your life seriously, but take yourself a little lightly can help. To paraphrase a teaching of Dogen in Zazen Shin, do not take your suffering lightly, but also don't give it unnecessary weight. Don't give weight to your thoughts and emotions and memories, but don't take them lightly either. Make your mind clear and sharp. So he's really talking about how do we, in this paraphrasing, how do we come close to that fire which burns and not get burned, right? Be able to hold and sustain that within our journey, right? I wasn't so good at that in my early years, I would say. Taking myself lightly, that's the part I wasn't very good at. There's a koan in both the Book of Serenity and the Blue Cliff Record where Yunmen, Master Yunmen, says the ancient Buddhas and the pillar merge. What level of activity is this? What level of activity is this? The Buddha and the pillar merge. And Hong Zhu, in versifying that, says, transcending perception and objects, it's so, yet nothing is so. Going beyond emotional assessment, it's met, but nothing is met. Clearly, wherever you contact it is abundantly evident. It made me think of how, when I was in college, undergraduate school, studying mathematics, I had a professor in an upper division mathematics course who, in the room, there were three full walls of blackboard. And he would start over here, and through the course of 1 hour, he would fill the entire three blackboards with a proof, never stopping to say, any questions? Everybody understand? Are you with me? And I would just madly be trying to copy everything down and go back to my apartment and try and figure out what the hell is he talking about. But the thing that was so maddening was often at the very end, he would turn around and say, so obviously. And I would have death wishes at that point. Zuido, on the same Koan offered this. He said, in suffering, happiness. In happiness, suffering. What says that gold is like shit? And then he says, those with eyes will see this, will understand this. Try and brush it off and look. Uh-oh, what a pity. But say, is it a Buddha? Is it a Buddha or is it a pillar? So both of these teachers are pointing to something. Shurto says, ask the pillar if you want to know. Shurto was a student of Huainong, so this is very early in the Zen tradition, China. When Huainong died, he went to study with Qingyuan, who was another disciple, an heir of Huainong. He's also the author of The Identity of Relative and Absolute that we chant each day. Go ask the pillar, Shurto says. So in Mahayana Buddhism, there's an emphasis on realizing the emptiness of self and other, self and phenomena. Everything that we hold within and everything that we regard outside. And in pointing to the pillar, he seems to be pointing to phenomena. But can we separate that from oneself? If we're trying to be free of our own suffering, why point to anything outside? What does a pillar have to do with it? To see that all the world is mind is the path of liberation. That we cannot have a single moment of experience, of perception, of sensation, of thought, of response that doesn't come through mind, that isn't perceived by mind. And so what if this mind is cloudy, opaque, agitated, distressed, shut down, closed off, arrogant, not inquiring? How do those different states affect that perception? Bodhidharma said, this mind is Buddha. To seek enlightenment beyond or apart from this mind is not possible. The reality of your self-nature, freedom from cause and effect, this is what's meant by mind. You can't know your true mind as long as there's still deluded thinking. It's not the Buddha's fault. Those who are deluded are unaware that their mind is Buddha. Otherwise, they wouldn't look outside of this mind. It's not the Buddha's fault. I would add, it's not the teacher's fault. It's really not a matter of fault at all. Delusion is not a sin, right? Delusion is not a mistake, even though it leads us to do many mistaken things. Delusion is a basic human state. It's a state of mind. It's impermanent. It's not who you are. There's nothing inherent in it. But it is universal. It is common to every single person. It arises out of our perception through our senses that there's a world outside, that there are objects that are not you. And then we impute into that a whole world full of meaning, and then base everything on that meaning. And so to know our own mind is to know the nature of things. And so we sit. Right? I think when we really begin to understand the situation and we want to do something about it, and we begin looking at how did the situation come about, and what is a skillful way through, then Zazen pretty much becomes the only logical response, not the only logical response, but the necessary response, to sit moment after moment, to face this mind, which is the source of the world as we know it, to face that that opaqueness, to face all of those things that arise that color, create, distort, upset this world that we each create, and begin to see through. So to face the wall, as Bodhidharma said, facing the wall is nothing other than facing this mind. And it doesn't matter what appears. And so in Sesshin, we simplify that landscape, that wall, if you will. We simplify any stimulation of the senses. Right? So the big sensory experience of the day is breakfast. We simplify all the complications that arise out of being in conversation, having dialogue, of working, planning, problem solving, relationships, and so on. And we enter into silence. And silence is a different way. It is solitude. It is a practice of solitude. It is to allow you to go into this study of your mind in as simplified or as rarefied a landscape as we can create. It's also a different way of communicating. And I was saying to somebody earlier, you know, when we talk, when we have conversation, that's a wonderful way to communicate, right? We do a fair amount of that. But when we stop talking, both internally and externally, there's a different kind of communication. I was saying to one person, it's like when you go into the woods, to the forest, alone, and you're quiet, and you just stop, and you let your senses be filled without trying to make anything happen or do anything. You're not trying to have a communication. You're not doing anything. You're just being simple. In that moment, if we're quiet enough, if we're open enough, we will begin to experience a communication with the earth, with the woods, with the trees, right? Which is not the stuff of Walt Disney or poetry. It's a deep level of communication in which something is experienced, something is known. And so it's like making yourself plain like water in Sesshin to bring forth your bare essentials of mind, of your heart, of your inquiry, of your intention, of your commitment, and to lay things bare so that when things do arise, all of those things that bind us, they can be seen nakedly, right? Without distraction, which makes them stronger, which makes them often more difficult, right? Because they're not cloaked, there is no distraction around them. And so that's why it takes a little bit of courage and skill and steadfastness and support to be able to hold yourself in those moments and not freak out or shut down or turn away. When there aren't so many concerns, now we can begin to see. Sherto says, if you want to know, ask the pillar. And so in that moment, I imagine that Sherto pointed and said, ask the pillar. There was a pillar right there in the hall. And so in that moment, there's an object that arises. And the eyes of this student make contact with that object. And there's a sensation within eye consciousness. And there's a recognition of something. Pillar. It has a name. It has color and qualities and size and shape, and it's becoming known faster than we can see. And so is Sherto actually saying, when he says, ask the pillar, is he actually saying, come closer? Now, come closer still. The student sees the pillar. He hears Sherto's answer. He might be wondering, what does this have to do with anything? How does this answer my question? And Shurto is not answering his question. He's pointing him in the direction so that the student can answer the question himself, which is the only way. And in that way, is answering their question in the best way, in the only way that will help. And the student says, I don't understand it. And Dada Roshi in his footnote says, this is understandable. It's understandable that the student doesn't understand it. This is where it begins. This is the first necessary step, is actually acknowledging and being able to own, I don't understand this. Which sometimes is very difficult in a world where we get a lot of rewards and kudos for understanding, knowing, whether you do or not. We're not given much encouragement to actually not understand, to not know the answer. So that's the first step. So Dogen says, put your question, put your inquiry, put your whole being to this pillar, and now practice intensively with a wall, with your mind. If you want to go through this barrier, you must first see that the mind and objects are one reality. Your mind and the pillar are not apart, not separate, not two different things. Then all dualities merge into a single thusness. At this moment, you and it is and is not, good and bad, right and wrong. These are no longer present, no longer exist. Where is that pillar before you see it? Where is your breath, this breath, before you breathe it? Where is the thought that just arose in your mind before it arose in your mind? What is the intimate communication, the intimate relation between you and things? What does it mean that the three worlds are mind? Why, in trying to liberate ourselves in this world of suffering in so many forms, do we sit and face our mind? Why don't we just go out and try and solve all the problems? What would we solve them with? What would you use to solve the problem? Before you pick up a tool or a phone or a pen or create a strategy, what would you use to solve the problem? How reliable is that? In the space before knowing, before recognition, before naming, before comparing, at just such a time, Dogen says. And isn't this exactly what you're cultivating in your Zazen, that you're sitting with your practice, whatever that might be, and not bringing in naming and recognition and comparing and judging, but just that root practice? If it's breath, it's just the breath before you name it. If it's a koan, it's just the koan without thinking. If it's shikantaza, it's just awareness without the idea. And then when something arises, to be able to experience it before naming, before it becomes something in your mind, before you know it. Now, all of those clouds have dissolved. Now we are seeing not the self, but one true suchness, things as they are. So what good is this in your life? How does this free you from what binds you? Well, in a certain sense, it's no good at all. It's useless, it's pointless, it's meaningless. It can't be understood. That's the revolution. Now, at just such a time, free of every launching pad, into loving and hating, wanting, rejecting, being better or worse, advancing or retreating. Now, how is it? Now, bring that forth into the burning. Because now it's not you. It's not about you. But it is entirely reliant on you. Transcending perception and objects. It's so, but nothing is so. Nothing is denied. Nothing is denied. That's such an important, profoundly important thing to understand about Buddha Dharma, particularly because there's so much teaching and language that seems to be denying or negating or saying no to just about everything. And what that no is no to all of the ways in which we grasp and cling and identify and reject and separate. It's the no to our delusion. And yet ultimately, even that no has to fall away. Because delusion is just another state that is free in and of itself. Nothing is denied. And so in your practice, that's very, very important. Because it seems like when the stuff that arises that you don't like, that is bad, all the bad stuff. Of course you should deny that. Get rid of it, extinguish it, shoot it, kill it, bury it, give it to your neighbor. Right? And that would make sense if it were something that was not you, right? But even, you know, so think of like something that is so important to you, right? Something that you use, you rely upon, and then it breaks. Oh, well. So now it's trash. In one instant, transformed from something meaningful into something completely trash. And now you put it in the trash can and it goes away. How nice. But where does it go? It doesn't go away. When we deny, nothing goes away. It goes into someone else's backyard, which is both yours, but others, other people's backyards, because we act out of that. And so nothing is denied, but nothing is affirmed. So all of the good things that we would want to hold on to and make precious and put into our little secret vault where we can go and have little nibbles. And not because this is good conduct or the right moral thing to do, but because the basis of rejecting and affirming is based on that very illusion. It's not you. And so when we do that within our practice, within your mind and body, it's just a various states of war against yourself. How could that work out? And so that's why we speak of it as mind training. And so in suffering, as that arises, to have faith that herein lies our happiness. Not because there is something noble about suffering, and the more you suffer, the more noble you become. As you suffer into martyrdom, it's not that at all. The Buddha said, if we want to be free of suffering, let's stop creating it. It's that in that mind of suffering is the mind of liberation. It's never anywhere else. And in that suffering itself is the key. Because the machinations that bring forth that suffering are the key to how to release it, dissolve it. So Sherto said, ask the pillar if you want to understand. And the student said, I don't understand. And Sherto said, I don't understand it either. Daroshi's footnote says, this too is understandable. I don't understand it either. And then the essential question is, both of these expressions of non-understanding the same? And Dadarushi says, if you say they're the same, then what's the point? But if they're different, then there are two worlds. And we're just right back where we started. Choose the one you want and keep the other one away. Or if we try and get clever and say, well, they're both the same, or they're both not the same. Right? Now we're just into mental and verbal gymnastics. There's another way. There's another reality. How do we trust enough to let go? You already know because you're doing it. And sometimes that trust is right there and you don't even see it as trust. You just let go. But there's trust there, because otherwise you simply wouldn't. And other times things arise that are not so easy. And it's not so easy to let go. And maybe we don't want to. Maybe we don't trust. Or maybe we do trust. And we're practicing right out of that faith, but it's just that path of non-attachment requires some patience. And in letting go, it's not just of the object. It's of knowing. It's of being in control. Whoa, now wait a minute. What are we talking about here? I'll let go of being in control as long as I can be in control of letting go of being in control. Can we work that out? Not really. All of the things that are the expectations, the measuring and comparing, all of the things that are so dear to us, even if they're weighing heavily, what kind of faith is required to actually relinquish? Which has to be done freely. Sometimes it's freely with a little struggle, under duress, out of desperation. Desperation can be a very powerful motivator. But it has to be done freely. That's why each of us has brought ourselves to this cushion. Has to be that way. Every time. It's not the monitor, it's not the Han, it's not the schedule. It's you. Take delight in that. Recognize that. Appreciate how much you know what is good for you. Shurto says, I don't understand either. And so here he's giving this student his mind. He's saying, it's not about understanding. You're not understanding. You understand. You know that you don't know. Start there. When you relinquish that and you don't immediately reach for another grab hold, how is it? Dadarushi says, there's no place to search for the truth. Even though it's right beneath your feet, it can never be found. It can never be understood in that way. Despite all of the teachings, all of the sutras, they're doing exactly what Shurto is doing. They're just pointing. They are pointing just. And so to let go of a formula, of a safety net, Trungpa Rinpoche said, yes, you are falling without a parachute, and yes, there is no ground. And that's already true. It doesn't start happening when we practice. It doesn't happen when your mind becomes still. It doesn't happen in the moment when you're right at the threshold of letting go of something profound or of a realization. It doesn't happen at that moment. It's happening now. Delusion, in a way, is our attempt to domesticate that degree of wildness. And so Dadarushi says, look at springtime. How is it? How is this right beneath our feet, but it can't be found? How is it falling without a parachute and no ground? And so Dadarushi says, look at springtime. When the snow has melted, the scars of the landscape are no longer hidden. That snow that so beautifully makes all things one color, one flavor, one texture, right? All of the scars and the holes and the ragged edges, it just makes us very beautiful, smooth, lovely. And then it melts. And so he's saying, let your snow melt. Let the wall crumble. Let your heart be vulnerable. Let your skin drop off. Let your faith become strong. These scars are the signs of your human life. Everyone has them. I remember in Annie Dillard, I think it was teaching Rock to a Stone to Talk. I don't know if I'm remembering the name of that book right, but I think it was in that book, she talked about seeing a daddy long leg or some spider that was missing several of its legs. And she was watching it and she thought, oh, you've had some adventures. You've lived. You have gone through some things and have scars to show it. And I thought it was such a wonderful way of looking at what we would see as something missing. And those scars that each of us have, we share with every human being, caused by our own actions and the actions of others. What meaning do they have? What meaning do you want them to have? How is it when you allow yourself to go beyond what they mean? Look at springtime. Every day, every moment, it's alive. Its aliveness is not based on its meaning.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.